Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 18, 2015, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the new book, Saving Congress from Itself, Emancipating the States and Empowering Their People, by former Senator and former Judge James L. Buckley. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome, as I mentioned, two experts to our call today. We're joined by our interviewer, Robert R. Gassaway. I want to say three things about Mr. Gassaway. He's a good friend of the Federalist Society. He is a partner at Kirkland & Ellis here in Washington, D.C., and he's the former clerk of our other guest, former Senator and former Judge James Buckley. And we're going to proceed sort of with a opening remarks and an interview format. But at this point, Rob Gassaway is going to take over the program and introduce the Senator. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you so much for having Senator Buckley and myself. I'm personally delighted to join you and Senator Buckley for the discussion of his new book, which again is Saving Congress from Itself, Emancipating the States and Empowering Your People. I think many of your listeners know the extraordinary career that Senator Buckley has had in both the public and the private sector, serving, as you said, as United States Senator for the state of New York, as a federal judge on the D.C. Circuit, and as Undersecretary of State in the State Department. So thank you, Dean, for having us. And Senator Buckley, I'll kick this off by just asking the most open-ended of questions. In about 10 or 15 minutes or so, can you please explain why you wrote your book and what you hope to convey?
Well, my purpose is to save the Republic. And to do that, my book proposes to persuade Congress to abandon what has become its favorite preoccupation, namely the creation and exploitation of the myriad programs that distribute money to the states and localities for purposes that are the exclusive business of the states. I have long known such programs existed, but it was only recently that I became aware of how pervasive they have become. My epiphany began a dozen years ago when, on my retirement and return to Connecticut, I subscribed to a local city's daily newspaper. I soon found it filled with reports of federal grants in support of an astonishing variety of parochial purposes. These included, for example, a $1.5 million grant for the rehabilitation of a vandalized railroad station that had long since been converted to private, non-transportation uses, $200,000 for road signs welcoming drivers to what passes for a nearby city's historic district, nearly $2 million to replace a one-lane bridge linking two small communities a dozen miles from my home, and a $500,000 grant to widen two streets leading to a school. That last is my favorite example of congressional imagination. Those sidewalks are being widened courtesy of the federal Safe Routes to School program, whose explicit purpose is to fight juvenile obesity by encouraging children to bike or walk to school. I'm not sure parents will feel that that is the most cost-effective way to keep their children slim, but no matter, you don't turn down Santa Claus, even if the money he distributes comes from the federal taxes you pay or from taxes your children or grandchildren will have to repay. I also noticed the frequency with which those grants were announced by the congressmen representing the recipient communities. The fact is, securing federal grants has become today's favorite form of pork because it is free of the stigma of the old-fashioned kind in which a member of Congress secured federal financing for a local project that was utterly unrelated to any existing federal statute or policy. Today, bringing home the bacon consists of securing money that has already been appropriated. If it isn't spent in the congressman's district, it will be elsewhere. And that, I believe, explains the explosive growth of grants and aids programs from the 132 that existed at the outset of the Lyndon Johnson administration to the more than 1,100 that exist today. In 1970, when I was elected to the Senate, those programs distributed $24 billion. This year, they will disperse almost $641 billion, which will amount to one-sixth of total federal spending, and all for purposes that are the exclusive responsibility of the states. Congress finds the authority to enact those programs in a 1937 Supreme Court construction of the Constitution's spending clause, which has, as affirmed in the court's recent Obamacare case, authorizes Congress to use federal funds to, quote, induce the states to adopt policies that the federal government itself could not impose. To put it another way, Congress is licensed to dabble in areas in which it is forbidden to act, which it does by bribing the states to adopt Washington's approaches to problems that are the state's exclusive responsibility. But because Congress is playing on the state's turf, the court does insist that participation in the programs be voluntary. Unfortunately, however, those bribes have proven extremely hard to resist. The collateral costs of those programs are formidable. At the federal level, because those grants come with the most detailed instructions, their total out-of-pocket cost to the federal fisc includes not just the amounts distributed, but the expenses incurred in drafting regulations, screening grants applications, and ensuring that recipients comply with the federal rulebook. That additional work has been estimated to cost $1 for every 10 distributed for an additional $64 billion this year. The most significant cost to the federal government, however, may well be the diversion of congressional attention from the critical issues that only Congress can address. Studies confirm that its members spend a major portion of their time attending to constituent concerns that, unfortunately, tend to focus on matters that are the responsibilities of governors and city councils rather than on those of a congressman, matters such as public housing, job training, education, and unfilled potholes. But those are precisely the kinds of matters to which those 1,100 programs are addressed. The costs at the state level are so large and diverse that it is impossible in this presentation to describe them all or to give an adequate idea of their cumulative impact, but here are some of them. Federal grants, of course, add layers of state and local administrative expenses to the costs of the subsidized projects. But because they impose one-size-fits-all requirements on states as different as Hawaii and New York, they also prevent their officials from applying common sense and local knowledge in securing the best value for the money spent. Moreover, they can trigger a host of unfunded mandates, such as the Bacon-Davis Act, which requires that the equivalent of union wages be paid for construction work involving the expenditure of a single federal dollar, a requirement that can add as much as 20% to the cost of the work. The programs also undermine accountability because state officials bound by federal regulations can't be held responsible for the costs and failures of the projects they manage. And because those regulations are made by distant bureaucrats, frustrated citizens who are affected by those projects have lost their ability to decide how their tax dollars will be used. Of particular significance is the way they distort state priorities by offering lucrative grants for purposes of often trivial importance. Let me cite just one example. In a remarkable feat of grantsmanship, this past summer, Connecticut drew on six separate highway programs to secure a total of 80.2% federal financing for a controversial $500 million, 9.4-mile busway that, on completion, will save an estimated 13,400 commuters a dozen or so minutes a day. As the Hartford Current observed, Washington's approval of the last of the six grants, quotes, made Governor Malloy's crucial support for the risky project awfully easy, close quotes. It was then that the states felt justified in committing its $113 million share of the busway's cost. But that means that that money will not be available to help repair the more than 200 Connecticut bridges that are currently in danger of collapse on the failure of a single vital component, including 49 that are crossed by 1.8 million vehicles a day. But priorities be damned, state officials are simply unable to resist the seductive offer of four federal dollars for every one of their own. Advocates of the programs nevertheless assert that because participation in them is voluntary, states and their subdivisions can't complain about the costs and conditions that accompany the grants. Declining them, however, has proven immensely difficult. Money from Washington is still regarded as free, and what makes a refusal to accept a grant particularly hard is the fact that if a state does not participate in the program, its share of the money, money derived in whole or in part from its own taxpayers, will go elsewhere. As a result, federal grants have proven inherently coercive, and I say that despite the fact that 23 states have declined to increase their Medicaid coverage despite Obamacare's offer of 100% financing during the initial 3 years. However, is an exception that proves the rule. Having experienced the huge collateral costs of their existing Medicaid programs, those 23 states have merely declined to compound the injury. There is only one way to resolve the problems that have resulted from Congress's addiction to these programs, and that is to terminate all of them. They must all go because none is free of the cost I have described. But because federal transfers now constitute 30% of state revenues, Congress cannot cut off the flow of funds overnight. I therefore propose that Congress terminate the programs by converting all the grants to states and localities that the states and localities are currently receiving into single, no-strings-attached block grants, one for each state, that would be phased out over a period of a half dozen years or so. That would allow Congress and the states the time to adjust their respective tax codes to accommodate the successive reductions in the federal transfers. Now, I recognize the large political obstacles that my proposal must overcome. I believe, though, that its timing could not be more propitious. Recent headlines concerning the incompetence and worse at the IRS, the Veterans Administration, and other federal agencies has undermined the myth that Washington knows best. Furthermore, Americans still understand the virtues of federalism. According to a survey of 2013 polling data, they believe state and local governments are best able to handle the following responsibilities by the indicated percentages. Housing by 82% of those polled. Transportation, 78%, education, 75%, and welfare, 69%. Those are precisely the kinds of responsibilities that the Constitution has reserved to the states, the kinds that federal administrators have taken over. I believe that once Americans have learned the true cost of those programs, they will know they have everything to gain from their termination, both as citizens and taxpayers. And as we have learned time and again in the past, an engaged electorate can achieve political miracles. Just 3 years ago, an informed public had so stigmatized the practice of earmarks that Congress finally banished them. Eliminating the grants programs will be much harder, but by no means impossible once the public learns the facts. So I want to thank the Federalist Society for giving me this opportunity to advance that educational process.
Well, thank you, Senator. Let me just ask a few follow-up questions before we turn it over to audience questions. And my first is just to home in on the bottom line. You just said that there's only one way, in your words, to solve the problems that you describe, and that is to terminate all of these grant and aid programs. And I just want to confirm that that is your serious reform proposal and not just food for thought.
No, that is a specific proposal that I hope will be adopted.
And Senator, it seems to me that one of the signal analytical breakthroughs in this book is the idea of terminating current grants and aid by converting them into what I've now begun to call Buckley block grants. That is, single, no strings attached block grants, one for each state. We've heard that phrase used for a long time. Can you explain how your block grant proposal differs from other block grant proposals we've been familiar with?
In this sense, in that they will be, by statute, phased out over the period of over a period of whatever Congress decides. I have suggested 6 years. In the past, Congress has had block grants, namely no strings attached, no regulations attending the money. But in a year or two, Congress could not resist the itch to attach those conditions on them and therefore destroy their intended effect. In my case, this is the way mechanically it would happen. In the year that Congress adopts my reform, if State X and its subdivisions have been awarded grants totaling $10 billion, the legislation terminating all the programs would provide that State X would, in the first year, receive $10 billion, no strings attached, and then in the succeeding years, it would step down until there was nothing left in the pot. And that, of course, would provide the states and the federal government the opportunity to readjust their respective tax codes so that the states would once again be assuming total responsibility for those matters which fall within its exclusive jurisdiction. But the net effect would be, because of the enormous savings in the distortions and in the administrative costs, is that the individual taxpayer total tax burden would be reduced.
And Senator, just to underscore a point that you made, what role would you expect that federal administrative agencies and courts would play in administering these Buckley block grants during the step-down period?
The delight of them is that federal administrators would be out of business. That'd be part of the savings to the federal government because they will have no further responsibility. Now, if for whatever reason the Treasury neglects to pass on to State X the amount of money that Congress provided would receive during the phase-out period, then, of course, you go to the court to enforce Congress to live by its bargain, its Treasury to live by its bargain.
Well, that's a perfect transition to my next question, which moves from administration and legislation to the realm of constitutional law. And my question for you is, why is cutting these spending strings and moving away from the traditional grants in aid to these Buckley block grants so important as a matter of constitutional law?
We have this problem. I would hope that the case that launched this strange process, namely the one adopted in 1937 a case called Steward Machine Company. I would hope that the Congress, the Supreme Court, would have the opportunity to review its holding. Now, it can't do it under present circumstances as a practical matter, because it would be in a position of saying the federal government's 641 promises to the states are simply unconstitutional. Stop it. But if Congress has already initiated the process for phasing these out, then I think it is not an unreasonable expectation that the Supreme Court, in reviewing that old holding, to take the attitude it did in the case of Brown versus Board of Education. As you may recall, that case declared that on the basis of decades of historical experience, the finding of the Plessy case that you could have separate and equal education simply didn't pass muster. I believe that a 50-year record in the case of these grants and aid programs, it can be established that they are essentially coercive, therefore cannot fit within the lawful confines of the spending clause.
In picking up on that idea of essentially coercive, let me introduce a phrase that's much talked about in Washington these days, and that is rule of law. Senator, what are the rule of law implications from moving from a traditional grant in aid administered by an administrative agency and by courts to these Buckley block grants while the money is still flowing?
I don't see any, I think, put it this way, I think that this it really reinforces the understanding that the Constitution is still the ultimate law in our system. The Supreme Court, having re-examined its earlier precedent and determined that it was not correct, we have in place a mechanism by which the federalism, properly understood, is being restored, and the ability of ordinary citizens to get actual democratic control over what's happening in their own backyard will be reinforced.
Thank you, Senator. I obviously am fortunate in that I have lots of opportunities to talk to you about these issues and other issues on your mind. I want to turn it open to the audience for questions to see what's on their mind. Do you have any other comments at this point?
Yes, there's one. One of the strong arguments in favor of the present system is that it achieves a redistribution of money from wealthy states to poor states to enable the poor states to maintain certain levels of activities on set standards that we expect all Americans to enjoy, education being a critical one. And assuming that there is a federal responsibility that would authorize a redistribution for that explicit purpose, there is a far easier way to accomplish that goal without imposing yards and yards of regulations on everybody. If Congress felt that maintaining educational standards required some transfer from wealthy states to poor ones, it could achieve that goal by creating a block grant issued only to the poor states in proportion to their needs, with only one string, and that string is this money must be used for educational purposes, but it would be left entirely to those individual states as to how they see their children can best be educated.
Thank you, Senator. Dean, we're nearing the bottom of the hour here, and I was going to turn it over to audience questions. Do you know, or do you have any questions at this point, or do you know the best way of doing that?
Well, let me take you up on both offers. Let me first open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing up, and then I'll ask a question as they queue up. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that'll say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Senator Buckley, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for the senator, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see who's queuing up. Let me just follow up on the point you were just making, Senator. I wonder if you've thought about this sort of in the inverse when you talk about the wealthy states and the poor states and redistribution. I wonder if you have an unlikely ally for your proposal in some of the wealthier, more populous states like Illinois, California, New York, those who might be convinced that, well, just the math, I think, convinces them that they're getting back less than a dollar in federal grants for every dollar collected from its citizenry in taxes. Would they be an unlikely political ally here for a proposal like this?
They should be. In my state, Connecticut, which is the has the highest per capita income of any state, thanks to being in commuting distance from Wall Street. We send about $1.48 for every dollar we get back. On the other hand, we're a very generous people, and if the argument could be made that 10 or 15 of our cents could go to Mississippi, so be it. But incidentally, when you're measuring poor states against rich states, it isn't as simple as it sounds. And I'll give you the example triggered by my reference to Mississippi. Mississippians have 75% of the income as the residents of Hawaii. But the cost of living in Mississippi is only 50% of what the cost of living is in Hawaii, and I don't think anyone is suggesting that Mississippians should send care packages to Honolulu.
That's a great point. There's also the, I think, the factor of legacy costs, particularly in the states I mentioned, Illinois, California, maybe New York, where those states that are formerly thought to be fairly wealthy are now facing pension and other benefits, health care for retirees, legacy costs that some folks think they're going to have a lot of difficulty meeting, and maybe in that context they would begin to resent a little bit more paying out more than they're receiving back from the federal government. But
you're raising a very important point. When money flows in from Washington, people aren't aware of the fact it's their own money coming back to them, and so they are more careless in how they plan their entire budgets. But once states are responsible for raising all the money that the states spend on behalf of their own citizens, they are less apt to build up these extravagant pensions and other long-term obligations that are running them into bankruptcy.
I've got just one more question, if you'll indulge me. You have a unique perch where you've served the country for years as a senator and as a judge. I'm wondering if there was just a moment in time or an aha moment or an epiphany where this idea came to you, or has it been something that's just sort of been percolating with you for some time? How did you come up with the idea to begin with?
Just happenstance, really. As I explained, I retired, I read the local paper, and I start seeing all of these grants for trivial objectives. And then I started saying, my Lord, this is a practice. This is pork. And why do we have all of these programs? And then I started receiving some material from the Cato Institute, and there's one guy there called Chris Edwards, who focus on the costs of these programs, the collateral costs, the distortions in local decisions that are brought about. and so on. And that is when my own thinking crystallized, and I came up with a belief that the practice itself has got to be abolished, because if you don't abolish the practice, the incentives that come from people who have who have become career politicians whose focus is on re-election, that focus will consistently push them into a position where they scratch a constituent's backs and say, what's on your mind, and then try to come up with a program to meet that, even if it has little to do with the truly important constitutional responsibilities that members of Congress bear.
We're speaking, of course, with Senator and author James Buckley about his book. The title, again, is Saving Congress from Itself, Emancipating the States and Empowering their People. I should mention to our audience that the notice you got of the call has the title of the book, which is an active link to Amazon.com, where you can go to buy the book. It's also available in stores, bookstores everywhere, of course. We've got four callers now patiently waiting with their questions. Why don't we take that first question now?
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This is an old issue going back to at least when James Madison wrote a veto message to Congress striking down an appropriation for public works. And one of the things he did in that message is explain that the welfare clause, general welfare, is not a grant of power, but a restriction on the power to tax and therefore to spend, that it not be for redistributionist purposes. Now, I've also wish I had a nickel for every time I've talked to a staffer of members of Congress and been told that the constitutional argument I just made to them is the first they had ever heard that argument from anybody. So unless you get a huge army of taxpayers, you know, voters, to make these arguments, nothing's going to change. So we need to have another alternative. And one that I have proposed is to create a cause of action, as they define a jurisdiction, in the federal courts by which any citizen may go to court and sue to have an appropriation struck down on the grounds that it violates the welfare clause, as I have just explained it. If that were done, then you would recruiting a whole bunch of outsiders to come in, use the courts. Of course, it wouldn't strike down all of these grants all at once, but it would so impair them that you would have the same result over a period of time. And grants to poor states would not work, according to the Constitution as originally understood. The only way it could be done.
Let me interrupt if the senator wants to respond. Do you have a question, or let me give it the chance for the senator to respond if you have a question?
Well, I would say that there is the solution that you propose, I think, would have a large problem satisfying the requirement for standing to bring the suit. One alternative, in order to get the issue in the public eye and in front of the courts, would be for some governors to bring a suit saying that such and such a program is essentially coercive and they do not want to be coerced.
Now, when I say that the legislation to establish the jurisdiction would define any citizen as having standing, I would do away with a standing issue. Any citizen.
I'll turn that standing question over to Rob Gassaway, who knows much more about these ideas.
Well, let me say this, I don't want to divert this too much, but there's two things going on here. One is the scope of the general welfare clause and the issue of what the government can do. Can it only enact programs for the general welfare as opposed to local welfare? And the comment is exactly right. This issue has been around since the early days of the Republic. There were various public works programs in the 19th century vetoed on constitutional grounds. So that's one question. There is a question between the extent of the spending power in terms of its goals. But what Jim is really talking about here more is the form of the spending power, i.e. the mixing of two governments, the coercion of state government by the federal government. So if you think of the Steward Machine Company case, you're really thinking of the latter, of mixing two levels of government. And not to go on too much here, but I saw Jim field a question about interstate highways at a small lunch recently about this book, and Jim's response was, I'm not saying that the original constitutional rationale for interstate highways, the defense rationale, is unconstitutional. I would just say that you don't need two governments to build a highway. You don't need the federal government and the state government. If you want an interstate highway, there's no reason the federal government can't build it. So I do think the issues are related, but I think as the focus on the Steward Machine Company issue or case emphasizes, what Jim is really talking about here is not the so-called Madisonian versus Hamiltonian dispute over the General Welfare Clause, but what is a commandeering type of argument that would be similar for the constitutionists among us to the Prince argument, P-R-I-N-T-Z, in the regulatory sphere. What Jim is saying is we should also recognize commandeering in the spending sphere. And then just to make one more comment about standing, remember that there's both a constitutional and a so-called prudential aspect to standing. So the constitutional aspect obviously derives from Article 3. I believe that the current cases that preclude standing for spending clause challenges, the Frothingham v. Mellon and the Massachusetts v. Mellon cases from the 1920s, can be read as constitutional cases. So I'm not sure that a statute going just to prudential standing is going to get you there. What I would say, however, is, and to close, the special solicitude for state standing in the Massachusetts versus EPA greenhouse gas case from 2007 might be used to get where Jim is talking, namely where a state governor would have standing or a state attorney general on behalf of the state, notwithstanding the Massachusetts v. Mellon precedent from the 1920s, to bring a suit that says your spending program is coercing us or is influencing or is putting a thumb on our political scales such that we are making political decisions different from what we would otherwise make. And an analogy I use is in the Establishment Clause context. Obviously, we say that people have to have free conscience to decide whether I'm going to belong to Church A or Church B or Synagogue A or Synagogue B. I cannot have a financial incentive to join one or the other. I think and there's a special standing rule under Flass v. Cohen in that context. I think Jim's argument is similar when he says that governors would have constitutional standing, special constitutional standing for these spending coercion types of claims. So that was a little bit of a mouthful, but I think what we have to keep in mind here is the difference between governors and private citizens, prudential standing and constitutional standing, and the difference between a general welfare type of constitutional claim and what Jim is talking about, which is a commandeering through spending type of constitutional claim.
We've got five questions pending, so let's take another call now.
Yes, Senator Buckley and Mr. Gassaway, this is Don Haycraft. I'm a Federalist Society member down in New Orleans, and I want to say first, Senator Buckley, it's a privilege to be able to speak with you today. I enjoyed your discussion, and I wanted to ask you if you served in the Senate with Senator William Proxmire, who was famous for giving out Golden Fleece Awards. Were you in the Senate during his era?
That I was, and I was always looking forward to the next announcement. He was right on target.
Yeah, same. And it seems to me that those Golden Fleece Awards served a valuable purpose in bringing these awards that usually had to do with some seemingly ridiculous project. But you're talking about literally hundreds, if not more than 1,000 of these grants that are mostly without regard other than in their perhaps the brief press announcement by the local congressman. It seems like that there's no public awareness of the issue that you've raised, where Senator Proxmire was able to raise the idea of pork barrel of spending and wasteful spending in his Golden Fleece Awards, that what we may need to give your proposal some legs is some calling out of particular projects and pointing them out so that the public can know that that there's something ridiculous going on. And I was wondering if your book has some examples of some what might have been viewed as pork barrel politics.
Yes, I do. And I was quoting from a list put together by Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma, who, alas, has just retired from the Senate. But each year he had the equivalent of a Proxmire list of insane uses of monies, of grants money. In one instance that just comes to mind, something like $2 or $3 million to pretty up a single block in a town of a population of 1,500 people. Another was to a substantial amount of money to improve the runways in an airport that had no scheduled business. And the list goes on and on and on. I hope that we can find some successor to Senator Coburn. But one way or another, people in this country have got to become aware that the most expensive way to build a local bridge or to take care of someone who's poor with medical problems is to have somebody in Washington laying out the rules on how you do that, rather than having somebody at the site of the bridge or in the clinic calling the shots.
Sounds sensible to me. Thank you.
If you'd like to join the queue for questioners, we have four questions pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yes, Senator Buckley, it's a pleasure to speak with you. This is Bill Severson out in Seattle. My question is, have you given thought to perhaps political strategies for raising your issues? I agree with everything you say. I just seems to me it would be a difficult political education problem to convince the public to have their representatives undertake what you propose, because I think the idea of federalism is sort of lost on the modern American consciousness. And I'm wondering if you've thought about where there might be some entry points in the current political world for bringing back some real concern for federalism and with that the kind of success for what you're proposing.
It happens that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I met in Washington with practical experience in the political world on how you get legislation adopted and so on. And I will be meeting again in another couple of weeks in Washington to follow up a person who's come up with a detailed plan to do precisely what you described. How do we force Congress to face the truth about these programs? I won't try to get into the strategies now, because they're still being thought through. But the fact is, some serious people are working precisely on what you suggest.
let's continue with our audience participation here.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola, Texas Public Policy Foundation and contributing editor at National Review. Senator Buckley, it's an honor to be on with you. I wanted to focus on what I see as major political obstacles in states like California and New York and Illinois to the proposal that we have, which is, as Michael Grieve laid out in his great book, The Upside Down Constitution, and as Richard Epstein and I have written in a bunch of different articles, what was really the central driver of this expansion of the this use of the spending power was also a central driver of the expansion of the Commerce Clause, and that's namely the desire of uncompetitive states to eliminate the competitive advantages of competitive states, of regulation-light states and taxation-light states, so that we can all be uncompetitive together as a country. And
I'll be bankrupt together.
I'm sorry?
I'll be bankrupt together.
Right, exactly. And this all goes back in a way to an argument that was advanced by Daniel Webster in the child labor cases more than 100 years ago, which is the famous race to the bottom argument. And there always seemed to me something very strange or incomplete about the race to the bottom argument, but I was never able to quite put my finger on it. And I think that it might be that it's incomplete in the following sense. The whole idea of federalism is to have states competing for mobile capital and labor. And as Richard Epstein likes to point out, one of the great advantages of the modern economy as compared to the 19th century economy is just how much more mobile capital and labor have become. And these various schemes are at the federal level are really motivated by uncompetitive states seeking to neutralize the beneficial effects of mobile capital and labor. And so what the race to the bottom really describes is a race to the top, but yet for some reason the race to the bottom argument remains compelling well into the new century. And I just wanted to know if you have ideas about how we can defeat it in the popular imagination beyond just establishing as a cardinal principle the separation of state and federal operations.
You put your finger on an extremely important dynamic in the present situation. I don't think you can do much to persuade New York and Illinois. Well, Illinois has a new governor. Perhaps we can. But there are a number of states that must feel terribly upset about having their money contributing to supporting what they view as extravagance in states that are drawing so much money from the federal treasury. So I think that there is an opportunity there, especially with the governors in those states, to see if they can start the conversation going, and a lawsuit, of course, is one way, but to describe what is happening in terms that ordinary citizens understand. And I think you put your finger on something that will resonate with the average American citizen.
We've got two caller questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question of Senator Buckley, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. Hi, my name is Stephan DeGina. I'm an attorney in New York City. I just want to say it's an honor to be able to speak to Senator Buckley. I had seen him I think in 2013 at the NYPD Catholic prayer breakfast with Justice Scalia. But anyway, my question was, it seems to me that the point of all this is to somehow give Congress an incentive to not spend as much money. And I was wondering, wouldn't the repeal of the 17th Amendment also accomplish that? by having senators, you know, like, once again be selected by the state legislators. So this way senators would have an incentive to guard state power instead of expanding their own and federal power.
I think that's an important observation. I think that 17th Amendment has proven to be a step backwards. We are a coalition of small sovereignties and a large sovereignty, and the states should be jealous of the intrusions made on their prerogatives. Of course, a lot of the states have now been spoiled, but I think that that would be an extremely important... But I frankly don't see any prospect of that being done. There is another approach. When we talk about the importance of pork and the focus of the current members of Congress on finding ways to rub constituent backs, I think that is traceable to the fact that service in Congress has evolved into a lifetime career. And I have some additional proposals I call them ancillary proposals in my book. One of them that I think is very important is term limitations, limiting service in Congress to 12 years, which would change the psychology of people in Congress saying, I have an opportunity to serve, not an opportunity to earn a pension. And I know so many times when I was in the Senate that people felt one way about the merits of a proposal but voted the other because an election was coming up and they didn't want to offend this or that constituency.
Right.
So I don't think we can reverse the 17th Amendment, but maybe we could push the term limitations.
Okay, thank you, Greg.
We've got just one question pending, after which our lines are going to be open. So if you would like to ask the senator a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Just a reminder to the audience, the book we're talking about is the title again, Saving Congress from Itself, Emancipating the States and Empowering Their People. Take one more question.
Yes, sir. Senator Buckley, sir?
Yes.
It's an honor to speak to you today, sir. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm from Wichita Falls, Texas. My question is in regards to gaining enough approval of this idea, you know, to have it eventually seen put into action. It seems to me that there would be quite a problem selling the block grant phase out solution, not only to Congress but also the state governments. State politicians, you know, I would think they would be rather short-sighted, very resistant to losing federal money. Though the long view is money savings to the states, and while Congress would be very resistant to the idea of giving up such a significant amount of power to the states. So how would you see your solution progressing through the political landscape to a successful conclusion?
To make the argument and pound away, and there's incidentally, I think that there is the possibility that newly elected members to Congress who want to make an impact, who have not yet been corrupted by the system, might be persuaded to take the initiative to introduce legislation, to start the argument going on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long shot, but not an impossible shot. And I think we have to move in every direction to bring pressure where we can. Because the simple fact is that I can't think of any single reform that could have such a broad and beneficial impact. Because at one stroke, the adoption of my reform would reduce federal expenditures by one-sixth, rid Congress of a major distraction from the essential responsibilities, and it would restore the people's ability to exercise control over what's happening in their own backyard. Now, those are extraordinarily important objectives. And the fact that they are obvious obstacles for the acceptance of what I'm proposing, I think we have to push and exploit every possible avenue we have to make people aware of the costs of these programs and to start resenting the fact that they're getting $1 back from Washington for every dollar to 20 cents that they sent to Washington and with strings attached. I don't think it's an impossible task.
Thank you, sir.
We do have two more questions pending now. We've got about 5 minutes. We'll see if we can get to both questions, but let's take this first one first.
Hi, Chris Garvey from Long Island. I wonder if the federal money is more of a driver of pensions, or do you think perhaps that it is the local preference for putting an expense into the future as in a pension to be paid for by a future politician rather than pay for it himself today?
Unfortunately, that you're talking about human nature, and it's not restricted to the federal government.
No, it's a local problem, I think. The local people would much rather say, oh, yeah, I'll incur this obligation. I'll be out. I won't be the mayor anymore when it's time to pay the pension.
Exactly. But, again, I think that the weight of these pensions are now headline news day in and day out. And, again, I think the people in states with these problems are becoming aware of the problem, and we're beginning to see pushback on the government unions that are the principal negotiators of these extraordinary claims on the state treasuries. So I think there's signs of progress on that particular issue. Certainly we've seen some results in Wisconsin. There are other states that are pushing back on the pensions. One problem we need to address it one of these days is that states aren't allowed to go bankrupt. I think that in the last analysis, we have to be prepared to see a state go bankrupt.
Very good. We do have one final question. We've got a couple minutes, so let's take one more question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, back. Strictly speaking, a state cannot go bankrupt, which is part of the problem.
I know, but we can change the law.
Yeah. But what the problem that I have seen, there are members of Congress who might introduce legislation of this kind, but I know them well enough to know that they don't know how, unless we draft the legislation for them. Every last word, they're not going to know what to introduce. So we could have hearings and testify and all that, but when it comes down to it, the only way you can get legislation you want is to draft it. Same way in court, if you win the case and you haven't drafted the court order, the judge will turn to your opponent and get him to draft it. Okay, if we don't draft it, someone else will who is not our friend. So we have to do the drafting work.
My understanding is that some of those individuals I talked about a little earlier, people in Washington who are working on this problem, I believe that one of them is, in fact, working on the kind of legislation you propose.
All right. Let me check in. We've exhausted the audience's questions. We've exhausted the time as well. Rob, before I turn to Senator Buckley and see if he has any final thoughts, let me give you a chance to weigh in here if you have a comment or a concluding remark.
My only concluding remark, Dean, is to thank you for providing this forum for Senator Buckley. This has been very informative, even for me, who thought I knew a lot about the senator's views. So thank you.
Thank you, Rob. And Senator Buckley, a final thought from you?
Just that if what I have said makes sense, let us back it. Tell your friends about it. If you have any influence with anybody in public office, I hope that you will say, here is a problem and there is a solution for it. In the meantime, we are shriveling the opportunities of ordinary citizens to determine how their own governments are working, and we are running up unconscionable costs that our children and grandchildren will have to pay for.
Thank you, Senator. The message, of course, is contained in his book, Saving Congress from Itself. A reminder to the audience that this forum has been recorded. It will appear on our website in the next few days. Perhaps one way of forwarding this message is to make the link to the audio cast available to your friends and colleagues. I'd urge you to do that and move this message forward. It really has been a delight and honor to speak with you today, Senator. I can't thank you enough for joining us. To our audience, thank you as well for joining us and for your participation. A reminder that our next scheduled call is Friday at 1 p.m. when we'll be talking about civil asset forfeiture. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.